From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Next week, we'll see the UN General Assembly open for the year with a series of speeches by heads of state from around the world representing each of the UN's 193 members. As the world faces dozens of wars and an unprecedented number of refugees in the millions fleeing those, the United Nations is looking at issues of war and peace, as well as the plight of refugees and the international response to all of these. In our regular newscasts, we give these issues deep and broad coverage, and we intend to continue doing so. Today we discuss some of the possibilities presented by the gathering of the world's leaders in the face of a set of global crises that seem to be steadily deteriorating, with a particular emphasis on the region south of El Rio Grande, and that with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Tony Solo, welcome back. Always a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, thanks a million, Don. Thanks for having me on the program. And perhaps we should try and get into business as quickly as possible while our connection's still good.
Good, good. Okay, so we're recording this on Friday, September 11th. That's the 42nd anniversary of the real 9/11, when the U.S.-backed coup took over Chile and plunged that into oblivion. And that's something that maybe relates to what's going to be happening at the U.N. this week. And maybe we can start talking first about who's coming up here from that region, and then do our little historical background to the things today, maybe tie together Chile with other things that are happening in the region now.
Yeah, and I think the vote yesterday, was it yesterday? I think it was yesterday, on the
sovereign debt.
The issue of sovereign debt. And that encapsulates in so many ways a lot of the things that member countries of the UN who are trying to resist attempts by the United States and its allies, especially in the form of NATO, but not only in the form of NATO, also in Latin America, the way that the US and allies like the right-wing government in Spain are trying to impose their perception of things on, for example, Venezuela. And that whole context makes the this year's UN General Assembly particularly important, because in many senses, and the UN is perhaps coming up to a crucial moment in its history in terms of its relevance and how seriously it's taken and how seriously its structures can be used to develop a world of peace and prosperity. Or are they still going to be used by the United States and its allies to manipulate international affairs in their favor? And that's, it seems to me that the this year's General Assembly could be in many ways uniquely important in terms of the future of the UN.
You know, and all of this is coming at an interesting time. The Security Council presidency is in the hands of Russia this month, which is an interesting coincidence. Venezuela is a member of the Security Council, and this vote really kind of frames the what's gonna happen. It's almost as if they took a referendum already on the direction that they would like to see the UN go in.
Yeah, and I think there's been a suggestion that originated in under the presidency of the General Assembly of Miguel Descoto, the former Nicaraguan foreign minister, and he's been trying to promote the reinvention of the UN. And almost everybody agrees, even the United States agrees, that the UN in its current form is not helpful, but from different perspectives. And the fundamental question for the UN is it going to reorganize itself in a way that enables a defense and an implementation of basic international law? Now, one just has to think, the most obvious example, of course, is Palestine.
Yeah, you've got Palestine, you've got Yemen right now. There's really no disputing the facts of, about Yemen. And you've got Syria, where there's no enabling resolution for anyone to go in there and conduct military operations, and yet you have everybody bombing the hell out of wherever they want.
Yeah, and I think the 2011 attack on Libya was a massive wake-up call for Russia and China. And that's why Russia and China have been defending Syria within the UN Security Council, preventing the passing of resolutions that would facilitate a NATO intervention.
And they're trying. They twisted, you know, there was a consensus resolution against terrorism and against ISIS. And the United States has been using that to, you know, declare the right to even blow up the Syrian army if they interfere with their own proxies sent there to fight ISIS. It's like the most contorted reasoning you could get, but they're trying to weasel even that in.
Yeah, and the fundamental sore in international affairs that, and particularly in the Middle East, is the issue of Palestine. Now, how is it possible in 2015 for a colonialist settler state to continue its creeping genocide, its slow motion genocide of the Palestinian people? How is that possible? It's only possible because the United States and its allies consistently fail to implement UN resolutions that have been passed year after year for what, 50 years now?
Yeah. Well, you know, let's give them more credit than that. They've not only been, you know, laying down on the job there, they've been actively funding and arming the genocide.
Right. So, you know, and there's on the international scene that in many ways is going to be the context in which the UN General Assembly happens, and you've got they're going to be leaders like Vladimir Putin, who's been totally demonized by NATO country media. And there'll be leaders also, you pointed out to me, I'd forgotten this, but Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, is also going to be there. It's possible that Daniel Ortega may go, I don't know, and he tends not to participate in those kinds of arenas where he thinks the overall context is unhelpful. But he might. And it's very important that Nicolas Maduro is going to go there, because, absolutely, and he will be arguing from a progressive Latin American point of view for the UN to kind of vindicate its what should be its true role of insisting that countries live up to their international obligations, because that's essentially what's at issue in the frontier dispute between Venezuela and Colombia. Because for years and years and years, under the presidency of Hugo Chavez and now under the presidency of Nicolas Maduro, the Venezuelan state has fulfilled its obligations in terms of respecting Colombia's right to resolve its internal civil war. And Venezuela has not given active support to the FARC guerrilla, who are now in peace talks in Havana with the Colombian government, having been recognized in practice by the Colombian government as a political force, a legitimate political force within Colombia. You know, so, and Venezuela has facilitated that process, whereas on Colombia's side, Colombia has facilitated paramilitary activity destabilizing Venezuela. And there's so many incidents. I mean, there was an incident back in I think in 2005 or maybe 2006, I can't remember now, in which a group of over 100 Colombian paramilitary fighters were found on a farm, using a farm in Venezuela as a base that belonged to an anti-Venezuelan figure, and when they were captured by the Venezuelan security forces and interviewed, they admitted that they had been training to carry out an attempted assassination on the then president Hugo Chavez. And that's just one of innumerable incidents in which Colombian paramilitaries at that time under the protection and promotion of narco-terror president Álvaro Uribe. But now Álvaro Uribe continues to promote paramilitary activity to destabilize Venezuela, despite the fact that Juan Manuel Santos, the current president of Colombia, has tried to stabilize relations with Venezuela. And so what's happening on the Venezuelan-Colombian frontier is, in many ways, a challenge for the UN, you know, for the terms of, you know, are the United Nations norms and principles, the fundamental principles of international law, going to be respected or not? Is Colombia going to meet its obligations or not? And from Nicaragua's point of view, that question is also relevant because Colombia still hasn't formally acknowledged the sentence of the International Court of Justice in favor of Nicaragua with regard to the maritime dispute between Colombia and Nicaragua in the Caribbean. So is Colombia going to meet its responsibilities in that case? You know, those kinds of disputes are certainly going to figure in the discussions in the UN General Assembly next week.
For sure. I mean, you can bet that several people will bring it up. And whether it's, for example, President Daniel Ortega or the foreign minister of Nicaragua, somebody will probably bring that up too.
Yeah, sure. And that's, you know, the other issue, the much broader issue that I have no doubt at all that President Vladimir Putin, the president of the Russian Federation, is going to mention it and perhaps focus on it in his intervention, which is scheduled for the 28th of September, is the whole issue of how much longer is the United Nations going to permit the blatant, vicious, violent intervention by the United States and its allies in the internal affairs of other countries, and how long is it going to permit? Because this also is very relevant in the case of Venezuela, because it's the United States government and other public figures who have been deliberately promoting the political destabilization and the economic destabilization of Venezuela. Right. And that's extremely relevant on this anniversary of the coup against President Salvador Allende in Chile, because what's happening now in Guatemala, and I have absolutely no doubt at all after following up the election results and paying a lot more attention than I had done to the situation in Guatemala, that what's happening in Guatemala is very much an event manipulated by the United States government in the same way that it's manipulated events in El Salvador and in Honduras. And what it's done in Guatemala, it seems to me, is develop another aspect of its interventionism. And this aspect we saw in 2012 in Paraguay with the constitutional coup against President Fernando Lugo back then. We can see it developing in Brazil against Dilma Rousseff, right, where this week a group of Brazilian legislators in Brazil's parliament or Congress have begun to formulate a procedure to strip Dilma Rousseff of the presidency. And that's exactly what happened in Guatemala, where a UN body, the Council for the Investigation of Impunity, which is originally set up, and I think we mentioned this last week, is originally set up by the UN, I think in the presidency of Álvaro Colom, the previous president before Otto Perez. It was set up with a view to trying to resolve issues remaining from the genocidal war in Guatemala all through the 1980s and the period that followed. And it was kind of hijacked by elements of the Guatemalan opposition to Otto Perez, right-wing elements, who used it to used its procedures to focus on alleged corruption. And it was this manipulation of this UN Committee Against Impunity, Investigative Committee Against Impunity, that facilitated what is essentially a soft coup against Otto Perez. Yeah. And if you like, we can look at that in a little bit more detail. But I just think it's important to understand that what the United States, it seems to me, that what the United States is doing is it's taken the model that it applied in Paraguay. It's applying it now to Guatemala. And that has all kinds of advantages to the United States because they can say, oh, well, it's not a military intervention. It's not a military coup, which is what happened in 2009. And the United States had great difficulty managing its mealy-mouthed, hypocritical, cynical response to that coup, which obviously favored.
It had an ugly presentation at the OAS even over that. They want to avoid that.
Yeah, so they're kind of laundering their interventionism and making it kind of wash whiter. You know?
And when we spoke about this too, it's a really convenient tool, I would say, for them. Because it gathers constituencies. There's always a, you know, whatever problems, if people have a hostility towards the government, and then someone calls the government a crook, you know, everybody lines up behind that. It's not ideological, and it's also not even quantifiable. That's the thing that's interesting, because you have, you know, people who are in office who created the laws that govern what they do. And if they don't violate that laws, they still might be, you know, draining the piggy bank. And, of course, that's corruption. Or if they violate those laws and don't rob the piggy bank, that's corruption. I mean, almost anything that you can accuse them of corruption. And if you control the media, you know, people say, good, it's the government. Throw their bums out.
Yeah, and the facts are what they make them.
And they
the
did
facts
that,
are what they can manipulate people into believing. It's very, right. It's kind of postmodern, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all this, and you see the same thing around the MH17 disaster, where the facts have been manipulated and invented,
right.
and the real facts have been suppressed.
That's right.
And you can see that in the way the investigation into the whole MH17 terror attack has been managed. I mean, there's been a commission, but the one of the parties that may well have been responsible for the attack, the Ukrainian government, is actually a member of that commission,
right,
but the Russian government is not. And you can see that in so many ways, in relation to Syria, the alleged chemical attacks in Ghouta, for
right.
example, that
right.
all the facts are created.
That's right.
The more and more importantly, the facts are omitted. Nobel Prize winner Harold Pinter made this point in his speech when he won the Nobel Prize for Literature many years ago now. In his speech, he said, the violations and interventions and atrocities and terrorist attacks of the United States and its allies are completely ignored.
Right.
They never happened,
that's
even
right.
when they're happening. And that's how Harold Pinter put it. They're of no interest. And in many ways, it seems to me that the UN General Assembly next week is going to be an opportunity, perhaps
yeah.
a last opportunity or among the last opportunities
right.
for the United Nations to put a stop to that and to insist that the United States and its allies be held accountable for their crimes.
Along that line, let me tell you, what I see, and the reason that we're going to be covering this throughout the General Assembly, you know, that phase of the General Assembly's gathering, is that the possibility to construct a counter-narrative exists at that microphone. If you have one after another telling the story, then, damn it, maybe some of it'll get out here.
Well, I fear it won't, and I'm very pessimistic. I mean, I have a kind. Maybe it's just, you know,
well,
the time
it will,
of
it
year
hear.
Or something. I don't
it,
know.
It will.
But I just have a real sense of foreboding about the international scene at the moment.
Yeah,
because, and if you look, and one of the things that I've been coming quite aware of in recent months is the way that many alternative media versions of events are completely unrealistic, mm-hmm. and people talk about, oh well, there's going to be the dollar will collapse, the U.S. economy will collapse, and I think that's extremely unlikely.
Yeah.
And the U.S. economy is fundamentally a very strong economy, and although it's suffered all kinds of undesirable changes in recent years, the outsourcing of real employment, real production,
right.
and so that the U.S. is becoming more and more a service economy. But I mean, in my own country, Ireland, and in the U.K., that process got underway back in the 1980s,
right.
and you know that, and what that shift from a production economy to a service economy, from a manufacturing economy to predominantly a service economy, is one that facilitates the control of the elites,
yep.
and consolidates the control of the elites.
Yep.
And you can see that monopoly corporate capitalism is very deeply entrenched in the United States.
It's domiciled here. What do you mean it's domiciled here?
Yeah, So, what are the chances of Bernie Sanders, say, effecting real change within the context of U.S. electoral politics? Even Bernie Sanders himself says that even if he were to win the presidency, the people who become the president of the United States are essentially prisoners of a system that ties their hands behind their back, even if they wanted to affect real change. So, you know, and the prospects of some change in the overall structure of the United States seems to me to be minimal. And what does that mean for us here in Latin America and in the Caribbean? And we look around us and we see United States militarization of the drugs war, the so-called war on drugs, and you can see that militarization having extremely negative effects in Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras.
Colombia.
Colombia. Yeah.
Where did all those guns come from that they found in Nicaragua, in Venezuela, for example? And where are all the guns that will be used against Venezuela if and when somebody gives the order, whether it's Uribe or Washington directly?
Yeah, and just look at the actual U.S. military profile in the region. They have a base at Ilopango, just outside San Salvador. They have a base at Soto Cano, just up the road from the capital of Honduras, Tegucigalpa. They've got troops stationed in other parts of Honduras and also in various parts of Costa Rica. And there was a report that I read recently of an indigenous community that was frightened and intimidated by the arrival of a U.S. military helicopter in their community, apparently on some drugs operation. And so Costa Rica, you know, the country without an army, ha ha.
Right, yeah, right.
You know, I mean, they are very much militarized, thanks to the United States, and you know, I mean, so that's the reality in the region around Nicaragua, and the Fourth Fleet, of course, is patrolling the waters of the Caribbean, and the area generally, since it was reactivated back in whenever it was, 2009 or 2010, something like that. So, you know, there's. The profile of the United States vis-a-vis Latin America has barely changed. And I remember this vividly in the election, the 2008 election of Barack Obama. Here in Nicaragua, then U.S. Ambassador Robert Callahan, who is a longtime sidekick of John Negroponte of ill repute, Callahan was asked, do you think there'll be any change in U.S. policy towards Latin America under a presidency of Barack Obama? And Callahan replied, in effect, I mean, this isn't literally what he said, but in effect what he said was, U.S. policy towards Latin America has been very consistent for 50 years, and it's extremely unlikely that there'll be a change under Barack Obama. That's what he said. And so, and you know, I think one has to take seriously authoritative figures like Robert Callahan.
But he was wrong.
And
he was
when
wrong.
They say that U.S. policy towards Latin America hasn't changed for 50 years and is unlikely to in the future, they mean it.
Well, he was wrong, though, because Obama turned around and reopened Southcom.
Well, and also, I now there's been this reopening of relations with Cuba. And so Obama can point to that and say, oh, well, you know, my commitment back in 2011, or no, sorry, back in 2009 at Trinidad and Tobago to open a new chapter in U.S. relations with the region. I've kept my side of the deal. I've kept my word. And but, you know, and that he's done it in such a hypocritical, cynical way, because what's happening is that there's the military profile hasn't changed, and all that's changed is a recognition by the United States that it has to do something different diplomatically because it's got nowhere.
Well, you know, maybe so they needed somebody to be able to go spy on the people that are negotiating for Dos Santos. I think that's why they reopened Havana.
Yeah, and what they're doing is, and the Cubans are very well aware of this. They're preparing the terrain for their some modality of their soft coup.
Right, a color revolution, revolution.
Yeah, a color revolution. And I there was a very good article by Ricardo Salgado in published on Telesur in their Spanish section. I don't know if it's been translated to English, where he talks about this color revolution stuff and how and very much puts the events in Guatemala into that context. Yeah. And so, in effect, there has been very little change in real United States, meaningful, significant, substantive U.S. policy in the region. And I think that that, too, will be a subject of the interventions by various speakers in next week's UN General Assembly.
Yep, I agree with you completely. And next week we'll pick up with that because I think they start on the 15th, right? So we'll see who the first dozen or so speakers are, and maybe we can talk about that next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don.
Okay, Tony, thanks a lot. A pleasure as always. That's our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, live from Managua, Nicaragua. And we close with Venezuela's late President Hugo Chavez describing then-President George W. Bush as the devil and drawing applause and laughter from the assembled heads of states at the United Nations General Assembly, September 20th, 2006.
And the devil came here yesterday. Yesterday, the devil came here. Right here.
En este mismo lugar,
right here.
Huele a azufre todavía.
And it smells of sulfur still today.
Esta mesa donde me ha tocado hablar.
This table that I am now standing in front of.
Señoras, señores,
yesterday, ladies and gentlemen, from this rostrum, the President of the United States, the gentleman to whom I refer as the devil, came here talking as if he owned the world. Truly, as the owner of the world. I think we could call a psychiatrist to analyze yesterday's statement made by the President of the United States. As the spokesman of imperialism, he came to share his nostrums to try to preserve the current pattern of domination, exploitation, and pillage of the peoples of the world. An Alfred Hitchcock movie could use it as a scenario. I would even propose a title, The Devil's Recipe. As Chomsky says, here, clearly and in depth, the American empire is doing all it can to consolidate its hegemonistic system of domination, and we cannot allow them to do that. We cannot allow world dictatorship to be consolidated.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.